Welcome back. I'm guest host Lester Spence, filling in for Mark Steiner on The Mark Steiner Show, here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're joined by Dr. Jessica Schiller, professor of urban education at Towson University. She produced and directed the documentary Schools Out, Closing Baltimore Schools, with New Lens and the Baltimore Algebra Project. And they were also joined on by Dr. Pauline Lippman. She's a professor of educational policy studies and director of the Collaborative for Equity and Justice in Education at the University of Illinois at Chicago College of Education. I and a number of other folk have kind of examined the neoliberal term. And when we talk about the neoliberal term, we're talking about basically the growing control of business and business principles in a range of different institutions. And when I was actually writing about neoliberalism as it related in education, there was one work and one scholar I turned to before I turned to anybody else, and that was Dr. Pauline Lippman. So even though I've never met Pauline, I've never met you personally, I want to actually say thank you for your work, and thanks for joining us on the show.
Well, I'm really honored that you said that. Thank you, and good morning.
So when we talk about education reform, education reform has been like a buzzword for like the last, actually it feels like the last 10 to 15 years, if not further. When we talk about kind of quote-unquote neoliberalism and educational reform, what are we talking about?
You mentioned that it's sort of applying business principles to everything. And so when we think about education, we think about one aspect of it is turning everything in education over to the markets, from schools themselves through privatizing schools, through charter schools, to marketing all kinds of products to schools, tests, curriculum, et cetera. It's also about applying business principles to schools. So things like performance ratings, think of high-stakes testing, thinking of businesses that have a bottom line, and if a unit doesn't perform, they close it down. We see the same thing happening in schools. So we see business people, CEOs, running school districts, running schools. We see schools and teachers and students all being rated by performance standards. So that it's really what the language is being used is whether there is good productivity or not. So we're no longer talking about the things that really matter to parents and students and teachers in schools, about learning and human development and a sense of moral purpose and civic purpose. I think there are two big driving factors in this. One is that there's a tremendous amount of money to be made, billions of dollars to be made. The global education market has been estimated to be anywhere between $2.5 and $6 trillion. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that there is a global drive to turn education in really everywhere into human capital development. How do we turn the education system into a system that's just preparing people to work in different slots in the global economy?
Jessica, you've been doing a lot of work both as a scholar and as somebody on the ground kind of doing activist type work around this. Talk about how this plays out in Baltimore.
Well, in Baltimore, we've had neoliberal school reform practices for some time, including everything really that Pauline mentioned, from school ratings and testing products sold to schools. One of my main areas of work has been around school closings. And in Baltimore, that's become a huge issue because 26 schools of the 200 are and will be closing. And the way that plays out in the poorest communities in the city is that they're losing some of the only public institutions that they have. And that is always a detriment to any community. No middle class person would want to move to a neighborhood or a town without a public school or without any anchor public institution.
So there's one thing that people sometimes do when they're talking about kind of neoliberalism or maybe advanced capitalism, another way to think about it, is they talk about it as if it's kind of everywhere in every place, right? But if you think about – if we think about, let's say, charter schools, the growth of charter schools as a part of this education reform, the state of Michigan has a very, 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 very lax regulatory regime. That is to say they regulate – they don't really regulate charter school development at all in the state of Michigan. But at least in Baltimore, on the other hand, charter schools are heavily regulated. So there are some differences. How do those differences – play out in how charter schools function in a place like Baltimore?
You're right that the charter law in Maryland is stricter.
Yeah.
And there is more regulation. So one way that plays out is that the staff in any charter school in Maryland has to still be a part of the teachers union, which they don't in other states, which allows the management of that charter school or that network of schools to hire and fire at will. That doesn't happen here. However, that doesn't mean that we don't have problems with charter schools, especially in Baltimore. Now the charter schools are still locked into a lawsuit against the city schools because they are upset that they don't have the funding that they're due to do the work that they want to do. However, our previous superintendent argued that not only do they get what they need, they're getting more. And we need to kind of even the playing field between traditional and charter schools. So even though, you know, things are maybe a bit better around charters in Maryland, there's still struggles and still problems and still groups being advantaged by charters.
Pauline, could you talk a little bit about the Chicago context? Some people actually would argue that Chicago's kind of ground zero for a lot of this stuff.
We think of ourselves as a laboratory for all of this. We were the laboratory for high stakes testing that was one of the models for No Child Left Behind. And then, of course, we gave the federal government Arne Duncan, U.S. Secretary of Education.
The gift that keeps on giving.
Yes, the gift keeps on giving. That's right. That was good. In Chicago, it's now about 160 schools have been closed, turned around, phased out, or consolidated, which basically means closed. And at the same time, we have 131 charter schools opened. And if you look at where those two things have happened, they are all concentrated in black and brown communities in Chicago. Most of the school closings have affected black students. And that's where the charter schools have opened up. So we have neighborhoods that have almost no public enrollment school, open enrollment school left. And where there are neighborhood schools, they've been disinvested in. And then the school board, which is appointed by the mayor, opens up charter schools, authorizes charter schools that open up around those schools. And those charter schools have private funding. They have glossy new buildings, and they siphon off students from the neighborhood school. Then we have a loss of enrollment, and then we have a justification to close those schools. So you can't really think about the privatization movement and the expansion of charter schools without thinking about the way in which school closings paved the way for that. And this is in Chicago, and as you said, in Detroit, absolutely, and in other cities, this is concentrated almost entirely in black and brown communities.
Now, I have a question. And as an aside, you can join us with your thoughts at 410-319-8888, tweet us at Mark Steiner or tweet me at Lester Spence. And you can also email us at talk@steinershow.org. So one of the transformations that comes with kind of the neoliberal turn in general is that citizens are kind of transformed into consumers. So in the educational case, individuals are, you know, like whether it's charters or vouchers, individuals are transformed into consumers where they're asked to kind of look at all these different schools as individuals and then make the best choice for their kid. Now, if you were to talk to people just on the ground, I think people on the ground would say, wow, having choice is a good thing. Like, I want to be able to make choices, good choices for my kids. What's the challenge with that argument? And Jessica, I'll actually talk. I ask that question to you, and then I'll throw it back to Pauline.
Okay. I think the biggest challenge with that argument is how choice plays out in all realms. Some people really have choice, and some people really don't. If you're able to choose between some, you know, amazing school that has a teacher-student ratio of 12 to 1, and you've got all the technology you need and everything socially, emotionally to support your students, that's great. But first of all, a lot of people don't, and especially, like Pauline said, in black and brown communities, they don't. And so choice is not real choice. Often, and if your child has special needs, they've been deterred from going to charter schools, and so the choice is even further limited. And if you're a parent who's low income and needs transportation to school, with charters don't provide and private schools don't provide, your choice is even further limited. So it's not an even playing field, essentially. So yeah. You can't have when you talk about choice, it's not equal.
Pauline, what are the political consequences?
What do you mean by political consequences?
Yeah. Here's another question that gets at it in a different way. So some people would also say, like, if you were to talk to parents just kind of on the street, they would say, like, wow, we want our kids to be able to get jobs when they actually get out. Like, as an aside, we're talking about K-12 education now, but we also can extend this to higher education. So I'm sending my my second child to college for the first time. He leaves next week, and I want him to graduate and then be employed. Right. Most people will want that. What's the problem with thinking about schools as a vehicle through which their kids can actually become gainfully employed?
Well, sure. I mean, that is one of the roles of schools, is to prepare people with the kinds of knowledge and skills and dispositions that can help them get jobs. We need to be really clear. It's not education that creates jobs. It's the economy that creates jobs. So the reason that people are able to have jobs has actually nothing to do with the education system. It has to do with the nature of the economy. So we have an economy which I'm sure, you know, the listeners of this program are fully aware of, in which we have a very much shrunken middle. We have many low-wage jobs that are precarious jobs, not unionized, not even full-time. Students go to college. They go to good colleges. They get degrees. They graduate, and they can't find jobs. They're working as baristas at coffee shops for minimum wage or a little more than minimum wage. So actually, the jobs question is not an education question. It's a question about restructuring our economy. And the other thing is that actually most parents don't send their kids to school just so they can get a job. When you send your kindergartner off to school, you're not thinking about the job they're going to have when they're 25, you know? You're thinking about, wow, he's a good artist, and he's starting to read, or she's such a great athlete already at the age of 5, or, you know, she loves math. I want the school to nurture her, to love her, to respect her, to develop her as a full, beautiful human person that she already is and can be even more so. So this idea that everyone is, that every school is a commodity, that everything in the society is a commodity, and that we are commodities, is dehumanizing. And we need schools that are humanizing institutions, and we need a humanizing economy.
Wow. Yeah. What are you going to – so is it possible for you to take the mic and drop it such that it makes a sound? I wish that would be so dope. We should actually add that, like, special sound effect, like, bam. That would be dope. I have a Jessica. One of the reasons we came up with this bit was because in Baltimore County, there's a set of questions about about whether they're going to continue gifted and talented programs. All my kids attend Baltimore County Public Schools, and all of my kids at one time or another have taken gifted or talented classes. Where would you fit that move into this discussion, or does it fit at all?
No, I think it fits. I think it fits because, you know, when we think about ourselves as commodities, our children as commodities, and thinking about them as human capital investments, in lots of ways, that's what gifted and talented is all about,
yeah.
Right? You get your kids into that track or that program, and then you think as a parent, hey, man, I'm set, and I've got my kids on the right track to go to college, get a job, whatever. I know that the county is trying to take that away, actually for a good reason, to think about heterogeneously grouping kids together, which is great for all kids learning academically, socially, for civic purposes. And I think parents' worries about that and anxieties about that are about their anxieties about social position and potentially losing that position if their child is not marked as gifted and talented. They won't be separated in that particular way from the, you know, the masses of students that go to public schools, and they won't be special, unique, and potentially looking good to, you know, elite colleges and things like that.
Well, you know, so it's funny. So my politics, I think, are well known for listeners who are kind of familiar with me. And I think, and Jessica, they're well known to you. Pauline, I think they're well known to you if you are familiar with my work. But here I am. I'm taking my youngest daughter to high school for the first time, and I'm looking at her classes, and they're all honors classes. And I'm like, where are the GT classes? Like, what's up on that? Like, you need to do something with this GT. My kid needs to be. And I have to actually peel my own self back. I have to say, like, okay, what are you reproducing? Mm-hmm. Right? So this stuff, we can think of it. What we're talking about to a certain extent with these reforms is a project that actually remakes what our common sense is. Right, it actually changes and modifies our common sense, where people, even people with the quote unquote right politics, actually think about their kids and think about schools in ways that actually reproduce consequences that I think they find distasteful.
Absolutely. And yeah. Just to say that, you know, everyone's full of these contradictions, you know. I mean, I also have two kids in public school that I want to have, you know, the best for them, and I want them to have to be in some of those gifted programs, not because they are gifted, maybe, but because actually those are the programs that get the best resources,
yeah,
smallest class sizes and things of that nature. So, but imagine a world in which all kids had that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if we weren't always thinking about our kids and our needs and our ways of schools as a vehicle for social mobility,
yeah,
we would be thinking about this differently. And I think it goes back to what Pauline said about the, you know, making schools a more human place. And I would add to that, you know, also a more civically engaged place.
Yeah. And one element that I don't think we talked about, or it was implied but not explicitly stated. So one of the consequences of the kind of this move in educational reform is that people or institutions that already have resources get more of them, right? Because it's a market-based competition. It's not an equitable distribution of resources. So in this case, the gifted and talented programs, they get the most resources and far more resources, arguably, than resources allocated to people further lower on the food chain, so to speak. Pauline, I have one of the dynamics that comes with the turn is increased spending on policing and incarceration. How do we see this play out in school dynamics?
Yes, absolutely. And that's in the forefront of a lot of people's minds across this country and in Chicago right now, for sure. So the Black Youth Project 100 in Chicago, which is one of the organizations involved in the movement for Black Lives, has looked at the budget, and they claim that 40% of Chicago's budget goes to policing, if you look at all the aspects of policing. And this is at a time when we've already had massive budget cuts. We had the closing of 50 schools in 2013, supposedly to save money. And we have threats of more budget cuts. And so we have threats of 45 kids in a classroom. Many schools lost staff this year. We've lost art programs, librarians, special ed aides, all the way down the line. And there's a relationship. It's not just the budget. It's that when you close schools that are anchors in communities and you send kids all over the city to go to school or to no school at all and you destabilize communities, you create a situation in which there is a justification for more police occupation in those communities. And so instead of addressing what really makes communities safe, which is things like good quality schools, good jobs, health care, recreation, green space, healthy food, we have in this country as a whole, in our cities, and definitely in Chicago, where I live, an intensification of policing and police violence, and actually cut in the very kinds of things that would actually make people safe. And one of the main ones, of course, is schools. And that's not even talking about the militarization of our schools and the school-to-prison pipeline.
And it's interesting because you would think that those dynamics would only be present in urban school systems. But again, I'm in Baltimore County, and I think both my kids' middle schools had armed police in them, and the schools themselves were kind of structured in a way where they weren't prisons, to be fair, but they were prison-like, right? Like I had to make. Up to the point where I couldn't get it. You know, like you can't just open a door and go to a public school. You have to be actually allowed in, et cetera. Jessica, you want to chime in?
Yeah, I just, even in the county, so to speak, or the suburbs, first of all, we know there's increasing racial, ethnic, and economic diversity in the suburbs. And as we see that, we see schools turn more become more like urban schools. And so I'm not surprised to hear that at all. The county schools I've done work and research in are some of the lowest performing schools, and they're exactly as you described. But if you go to some of the more affluent schools, go to Delaney Valley, or you probably won't have that experience. And same is true in affluent schools, I think, in urban areas too.
You know, so what we're going to do is we're going to go to break in a second, but I have actually a trifling way. Well, it's not really trifling, but one way to understand how deep down the rabbit hole this goes. When my kids were at their elementary school and we loved it, they had a behavior modification program, basically a way to make their kids act right, where they would give kids money, like fake money to every time they did the right thing, they would be given money. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh my God, what is this? Now, the thing is, now if you think about the way they could have done that, they could have saved all their money and then slap the kid upside the head and be like, okay, I'm going to pay for that. They could have organized their money, right, as a class, but it never really functioned like that. It functions solely as an individual dynamic to make the kids act right, and then embedded in them the idea that they were kind of in a market of some sort, as opposed to in a school system. We're going to talk a little bit more about this stuff when we get back. Among the things I want to get to is the idea of pushback, because this stuff is contested in a number of different places. I'm joined by Dr. Jessica Schiller, Dr. Pauline Lippman. This is the Mark Steiner Show. My name is Lester Spence. At least that's what they tell me. Welcome back. I'm guest host Lester Spence, the good doctor, filling in for Mark Steiner on The Mark Steiner Show, here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We spent the first half hour of the 11 o'clock hour talking about kind of the neoliberal turn as it relates to educational reform. I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Jessica Schiller, professor of urban education at Towson University, and Dr. Pauline Lippman, professor of educational policy studies and director of the Collaborative for Equity and Justice in Education at the University of Illinois at Chicago College of Education. Thanks again, both you guys, for being our guests. When people talk about this turn, there's this tendency to think about it working everywhere and every place, and then similarly, there's this tendency to take it as kind of the state of reality, as if people aren't contesting it, as if people aren't pushing back. What I want to spend a little bit of time on is talking about what this pushback looks like and then how effective it's been. And for listeners, if you want to join in, please give us a call, 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner or me at Lester Spence. And you can email us at talk@steinershow.org. Pauline, I'll start with you. Just like Chicago's been ground zero for a lot of these changes, Chicago's also ground zero in a number of ways for efforts to kind of push back against educational reform. You've talked about the BYP 100. What are the other efforts going on in Chicago right now?
I'm so glad that you asked this question. Of course, we're here in Chicago, so we have to sort of rep Chicago. But
I rep Baltimore and Detroit. I feel you.
Yeah, right. But I think we've actually been fighting these neoliberal policies. There's been some stuff before 2004, but really in 2004 was Chicago's plan to close 60 to 70 schools and open up 100 new schools, mostly as charter schools, which is really, and then all the high stakes testing that came before that. And out of that, we've built a coalition that's really an alliance of community organizations and education groups and parent organizations that's been primarily led by Black and Latino community organizations and parents, but definitely involves in a very engaged way white parents, including middle-class white parents. It's citywide, and it's allied with the Chicago Teachers Union, which in 2010, a radical caucus in the Teachers Union won the leadership and is transforming the union into a social movement union, a union that's allied with parents and communities and fighting for broader education goals and really against this whole neoliberal agenda. So we have a social movement, an education social movement in Chicago. And I think that what we've done is we've moved from resisting these policies, and we're still resisting them, but moved from just resisting these policies to having an agenda, and that's a different agenda. And I think it's related to a lot of what we talked about in the first half hour, that the mentality, this neoliberal mentality, is also in the absence of a real alternative. And so there has to be not just a resistance to these neoliberal policies, but we also don't just want to go back to the way schools were before that, because they were also inequitable and didn't serve students well, and they weren't necessarily civic-minded. So I think that's the really exciting thing. We have a campaign for 50 sustainable community-driven schools. We have a campaign for an elected representative school board in Chicago that's very close to passing a state law. And we are really engaged in revisioning the kind of schools that we want in our neighborhoods and fighting for those.
It's
very exciting.
I want to ask you one question. So one of the dynamics that's really impressing me about what's going on in Chicago is the Chicago Teachers Union's mm-hmm. growing radicalization. There were one of the Illinois State Legislature, if I'm correct, they actually passed a law that made it much harder for the teachers union to strike. But the teachers union somehow actually met the criteria for that law and were able to strike anyway. Am I correct in that?
Yeah. So actually, Stand for Children, which some of us call Stand on Children, which is a national organization of, you know, it's mainly hedge fund operators and neoliberals who want to, you know, lead the privatization of public education. And so they pushed through laws in a number of states, and Illinois was one of them, that made a threshold just for Chicago Teachers Union of 75% vote of the teachers to vote to authorize a strike.
All the teachers, of not just of the teachers who come to a specific meeting, but all teachers in the union. Is that right?
All teachers in the union, yeah. That's right. And afterwards, you know, that we actually have, you know, there are videos. You can see that Josh Adelman, one of the leaders of this, sort of joked that, you know, that's the end of any striking that's happening in Chicago. And, in fact, in the strike in 2012, teachers voted 98% to authorize a strike. And when the strike actually occurred, which was a victorious strike, it was honored by basically 100% of all the teachers, and there were thousands of parents in support, and it was really a mass movement, and it was a carnival of resistance in the streets. So that's because there is a pent-up anger and frustration and demand for something really fundamentally different to happen for teachers and for kids in schools. And the teachers union has been a very powerful vehicle for that. But I really want to emphasize this point. It's not the teachers union alone. And actually, the caucus that is leading the teachers union now came out of the campaigns that were actually led by parents and people in Black communities and Latino communities against school closing. So it's been this alliance, this labor community alliance, that's moved things forward in Chicago.
Jessica,
it's a tough battle. So I don't want to leave the readers with, you know, violins playing and, you know, soft music. this is a huge battle for the soul of public education.
Jessica, could you chime in about the Baltimore context?
Baltimore couldn't be more different than Chicago in a lot of ways. I mean, Chicago has a long history of activism, labor struggle in that city. And Baltimore does not have that same history. That said, there still is resistance and pushback here. But I would say that it's mostly youth-led. The Baltimore Algebra Project has probably been the group at the forefront of that. They took over the school board a couple about a year and a half ago now, and held a people's school board meeting on the school closings. They led protests on the west side of Baltimore to save Langston Hughes Elementary School from closing. And they, for a long time, for many, many years, have been at the forefront of fighting for school funding and equity, the end of policing in schools and things like that. But it's a small group of people. There are other groups around the city. There's groups that are trying to fight for what they're calling community control of schools, to push for local school councils, which they have in Chicago, and which were instrumental in getting this movement that Pauline describes off the ground. There is talk and a push for at least a partially elected school board in Baltimore, but where that is, I'm not exactly sure at the moment. There isn't the kind of tight organizing and cross-sector organizing that there is in Chicago, but I think that there's a potential for that. The union, actually, in its most recent election, had its first strong challenger in years. Kim Mooney, who's a teacher at Roland Park Elementary Middle, got the most votes to challenge Marietta English, who's been the longtime union BTU president in a very long time. And she has a social justice agenda. But in terms of, like I said, you know, cross-sector organizing, I don't think that's quite off the ground yet. But I do. But since, you know, in the last and maybe you can add to this, too, I would say in the last year and a half, there's just been a lot of on the ground organizing, period, in Baltimore. Yeah. And so I'm kind of hopeful that that will translate into some more cross-sector organizing.
Now, another follow-up question for you, Jessica. So we brought up the county, that this stuff is going on in the county. The county, I remember when Corinne Gaines was killed by Baltimore County Police. One of the things that I thought about, because a number of people were concerned that there wasn't the same type of mobilization on her death, around her death, as there was in Freddie Gray. But the first thing that came to my mind was where you're talking about the county as opposed to the city. Mm-hmm. And the county is just a different space to – I'm not even – I've been here since 2004, and I'm not familiar with any real attempts to organize in Baltimore County around any issue. Is it me?
No, I don't think it's you. You know, Baltimore County has always been a very conservative place. The county executive in Baltimore County many decades ago was Spiro Agnew. This is a county that's voted down low-income housing within its borders, just voted down a proposal for Muslim school holidays. It is a place that is not always open to change, especially around diversity. And so I'm not surprised to hear that there isn't a lot of pushback in organizing. That said, however, I know in the teachers' union there's been a lot of pushback around some of the testing and curricular reforms.
Yeah.
But that, you know, teachers' unions historically have actually been in opposition to communities and parents. And that's, I think, you know, TABCO, which is the union in Baltimore County, hasn't crossed over and worked with parents a lot to support any kinds of broader changes. And so, you know, again, doesn't really surprise me to hear that.
So the county, what the county-city dynamic kind of reveals to a certain extent are the class dynamics of this whole thing. And Pauline, when you talked about, you know, who bears the costs, the costs are primarily borne by black and brown children in places like Chicago, Detroit, and Baltimore. But we're not really talking about black and brown children. I mean, that is, we are, but what we're really talking about is poor, working class black and brown children. To what extent, can you talk about some of the kind of the class dynamics within black and brown communities that may complicate the attempt to push back against these reforms?
That's a really good question. Well, you know, one of the things that we have, so part of the whole so-called Chicago school reform, in addition to the things that we've already talked about, is the expansion of selective enrollment schools, specialty schools that you have to test to get into. And so these are schools that that are primarily located in affluent and white areas of the city, or gentrifying areas of the city, and they've been a key sort of anchor for gentrification in communities. It's a draw for people to both for investors to develop in those areas and for people to buy, you know, expensive houses in those areas, because there's this sort of sense that you could send your kid to that school, and sometimes they have a neighborhood set aside. So if you live in the neighborhood, a certain number of neighborhood kids can go there. And there's been an expansion of these selective enrollment schools, and also of neighborhood schools, but that are sort of, you know, top-tier neighborhood schools. And so I think for especially for middle-class, more affluent African-Americans, in addition to private schools, which exist in Chicago, that there are these opportunities to go to these, send their children to these selective enrollment schools. And what that does is it kind of, it siphons off, it creates a safety valve, or an opportunity that's a class opportunity. Because you're right, that it's not just that they're black and brown schools, it's that they're black and brown, working class, low-income schools that are affected. So I think there is that dynamic, yes. Although I have not seen, and I might be wrong about this, but I have not seen that dynamic in play that much in relation to the resistance to these policies. In other words, we haven't seen like a vocal sector of middle-class black parents saying, no, you know, things are fine in CPS. The loudest voice has been working-class black parents.
Wow. What about now, Chicago, like Baltimore, has a large and prominent black political elite. How have they responded to your activities?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I think it's not only a black political elite, but it's also a black clergy. And there's a sector of the black clergy that have, if we go back to George Bush's, the first George Bush, 1,000 Points of Light, and I guess the second George Bush's, whichever one that was, faith-based organizations taking up the slack from the defunding of the state. We have a lot of churches that are tied into Chicago Public Schools. They get, you know, funding for after-school programs or whatever, and into the city funding in general. So I think that has had a major impact in blunting the role of that the black churches might play. And we have a sector of black politicians, and some of these black politicians are tightly allied with Rahm Emanuel and this whole neoliberal education agenda, and have, you know, been major obstacles. So there is that factor as well.
So we've got a caller, Ernest from West Baltimore, and then a tweet after that I'm going to try to get to, but we only have a few minutes left. Ernest.
Yeah, good morning. Dr. Spence. Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Now, it has been, it's not only Corrine Gaines, if we remember correctly, a young 19-year-old black male went to a drugstore to try to get some cough syrup with a prescription. The police chased him down a dead-end alley. He couldn't go any further and shot him multiple times. He was 19 years old.
Yeah.
And he was unarmed.
Yeah.
And the problem in Baltimore County is that Chief Johnson, he's never on the scene, but he always is making a statement about exactly what happened. And they never show the complete tape. And the county executive never makes a statement about what's going on. So when you have problems like this, when people know that things are happening and they're not making a statement for justice and not getting these criminal cops off the street,
yeah,
then you have these kind of uprising, and that's what's happening all over the United States. And actually, it puts the lives of good police in danger.
No, but yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Thank you so much, Ernest, for calling. I have a tweet from I think I'm gonna get the name. I apologize the pronunciation of the first name on Anakwenze Ogbu. In Western cultures, intelligence is seen as static, based on IQ or based on resources you have. Whereas in Eastern cultures, there's a focus on effort. I was wondering, Jessica, there's an increasing interest in kind of resilience in the idea of kind of teaching grit or resilience in schools. How does this actually play a role in educational reform in this project we're talking about?
Well, that's a really interesting question. That's gotten a lot of play nationwide in all kinds of school contexts. And grit is a complicated concept, as is resiliency. Poor kids, no matter where they come from, have grit and resiliency just every day in their lives to get through the day, that we're talking about measuring it, teaching it, incorporating it into curriculum. Seems to be another bad idea, school reform, that we might see scaled across the country. In California, they're testing it. And I don't know where that takes us. It's actually, in some ways, a distraction from all the issues that we've been talking about on this show for an hour, around power, economy, and politics that are the real drivers of school equity.
Pauline.
Yeah. Don't get me started on grit.
Yeah. and as an aside, I apologize to just get you started. I only have a couple minutes left.
I think in addition to what Jessica said, for me, I think the bottom line of this is that it's another take on individual responsibility, that if you're not succeeding, it's because you're not working hard enough. And yes, we acknowledge that there may be racism, there may be inequities that are economic, there may be gender injustice, whatever, but you can overcome these things if you simply work hard enough. And so it becomes an individual solution in which people are expected to somehow overcome these odds that they're facing. And so it individualizes problems that are structural problems. And it's another ideological piece. It's another piece of the mentality that you've been talking about, Lester, that I think is so important that we probably haven't talked about enough, that internalizes the notion that whether I succeed or fail depends on how much effort I put in. And, of course, it takes effort. But it's not an even playing field. It's more than not an even playing field. There's a set of policies that are actually set up to intensify the class inequalities and the racial inequalities that we already have.
And on that note, I think that's the perfect end to this segment. I want to thank Jessica and Pauline both. This is an excellent conversation. We've been having these conversations in Baltimore, Chicago, and other places, as well as politics around them. But I really, really appreciate the work you guys do intellectually and on the ground. Up next, we're going to have an update from the City Paper featuring Karen Hooper.